Welcome to Black Op Radio, a voice of political conspiracy research. To call in, we have a secure line ready. Area code 604-525-4167. Again, just call area code 604-525-4167. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. And now your hosts, Anita Langley and Leno Sanard.
Good evening, this is Black Op Radio.
Good to hear you, Anita.
Yeah, you too.
Tonight we're going to have Jean Hill on with us, and she was a witness to the Jack Kennedy assassination. She was there and one of the few people still alive that is willing to speak about it. She's been in many books, and I think she had written a book, The Last Dissenting Witness. We'll see if we have her on the line. Hello, Jean.
Hello there.
Glad you could be on the show tonight.
Thank you.
We have a few questions for you. Like all the witnesses, there are several people who have come out to rewrite history, and we want to get things on the record right from the source. And just starting from the beginning, what happened on November 22nd from your eyes?
Okay, I had just moved to Dallas not a year before. And my friend Mary Mormon and I went to see the parade. We were both dating policemen who were going to be in the parade. Her boyfriend was going to be the point man or lead man of the parade, and mine was going to be riding on Kennedy's wheel. And so we went downtown that morning and found our good parking spot, thought we'd see the parade along toward the end of it. And I wore a red raincoat so I could catch his eye. When we got down there, there were a lot of crowds, a lot of people. And so we wanted to go across to the triangle down there across from the school book depository. But we weren't allowed to. When we started across, the young cop beckoned us back. And I went up there and talked to him and flirted with him. And he let us go over there. So that turned out that we were in the kill zone as it happened during that time. Okay?
Okay.
Now, there's certain events describing which way gunfire came from and where debris sprayed out. From your impression, where did you believe shots to come from?
Well, I saw a shooter behind the fence on the grassy knoll. And the debris and so forth, the brains and the blood hit my boyfriend's helmet. And he was riding...
Just to the left, rear left?
Right.
We can actually see him in the movie then.
Yeah,
the Zapruder film.
Yeah, the Zapruder film and I think other films. Now, from your point of view, there has to be multiple shooters then that day. For sure there was someone shooting from behind.
Right.
You're quite clear that there was shots from the front.
Yes, I saw the man.
Right. Now, what can you add to that about you saw a man? Did you saw a puff of smoke, a flash, anything?
Right. A puff of smoke, flash of lights, and a rifle. And
caught a glimpse of someone right up there.
And caught a glimpse of someone up there that
Now, I'm not exactly sure if it was you or Mary Mormon, but someone also claimed to see someone running right from the grassy knoll area towards the school book depository?
Yes, it was me.
Right.
And the man I saw, I said later when I saw him on Sunday kill Oswald, I told my daughter, I said, that's the man I saw running. Because the same side view I had of him, I had that same time when he killed Oswald.
Right. So it's your impression.
It turned out to be Jack Ruby.
Right. That he was up in that area. But it's not your impression he was a gunman. He was just there and
well,
probably...
Well, I just felt that he was in on something because he was trying to... He was the only person moving and he seemed to know what he was doing.
Right. Right in that instance of shock
right.
Where people disbelief and there is already somebody activated, spurred into action. So he knew something was up. Okay, that's gone down. My next move is to get over here or to plant evidence or help people get away. So right after you witnessed this flash on the knoll, did you go running up the knoll or were you approached by policemen?
No, I tried to run across the street, and I got caught in all the traffic and everything, and my boyfriend was still making a turn in a tight circle, which I asked him, and he almost ran me over. And I asked him later, because I was trying to run across the street to get to that man, and he says he never did see me that day. So the one man that I wanted to see, I never did see me. So I think everyone else did, though. So I came back to get Mary up and stooped down beside her to get her to come go with me because I'd lost my nerve a little. And she wouldn't get up, so I left her. And I ran up the steps and right on to the back of the pagoda.
Right, along with a horde of other people by
right,
that time,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
And trying to find this man, and when I looked back and saw a police uniform, I thought, well, you know, he didn't go there because the police would have gotten him. And so the side trip I made ruined my momentum, and I had lost sight of him.
Right. But it was unmistakable that, from your point of view and others right there, there was gunshots, something, activity right up there. There was no mistaking.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right up there. So this is just
never been any
instinctive reaction. Like, what? That's it right there. They're up there. Let's go see what happened or grab them.
Right.
And I think, you know, that was the general feeling there right seconds afterwards. I'm not sure if it's the policeman you're speaking of, but somebody dropped his motorcycle right there on the sidewalk and was running up. His name is
Right, that was Officer Hargis.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, we knew him too. And he went running up also. But
this is important, though, because it's an instinctive reaction. It wasn't that people were just kind of milling around wondering what happened. They knew right away.
No, it wasn't just a feeling.
Yeah.
I mean, even my friend said later, you know, that they felt that shots were coming from all around. And they felt that they were going to be killed, too. So, and in a situation like that, I imagine they thought they were going to get hit.
Right. Well, that was the instinctive reaction of Connolly. I think his records are his words were, "My God, they're going to kill us all."
Right. I don't understand why, if it's all so innocent, why would they not let us have the bullet fragments from Connolly's arm?
Oh yeah.
And clear it up.
Well, that was just, if you look at it from their point of view, I mean, if you get it cut and dried and you say, listen, there was a coup d'etat, certain people orchestrated this, certain
right.
people moved the chain
I mean,
of
there are so many things. I mean, like, for instance, when they took the pictures from me, they walked up and put their hand in my pocket, in the correct pocket, and took my pictures away from me.
Right. Now, can you just describe that for a moment? Who was that and how many people approached
Well, it was a... the man flashed Secret Service ID at me and said he wanted my pictures, and I said, what pictures? I said, come with me. I can identify this guy. Come help me. And he wasn't, you know, he wouldn't do it. So I broke away from him, and I hadn't gone a step when another guy stepped in, I assume was Secret Service also, and he's the one that grabbed my pictures out of my pocket. And they didn't ask, they just took them. And then they put me in a very painful hold and took me to the courts building.
Well, that tells you that they were actually doing surveillance on the area.
The minute I got in this place in the courts building where these men were sitting, watching it was like a theater seat because you could see everything right down on the nose. So I felt like that they had must have been. Of course, I didn't think all this at the time. Now,
yeah, no, exactly.
Because you don't think and you don't know why they. But I did think it was odd that they did ask me, "What did you think when the bullet struck at your feet?" And I said, "I didn't know that one did." And they said, "Well, yes, it did." I said, "We thought maybe you or Mary had been hit because she went down so quick." And so they'd evidently seen me putting the things in my pocket, and they knew what to do.
Right. Right at the time of the shooting, you were the one who was waving at the president, I understand?
Right.
I recall? Right. So that's how close you were to there, so you would have been in...
I was within 10 feet of the car.
Right. And they people watching, according to you, actually thought that you might have been close enough to be in the rain of fire.
Right.
And have been hit by a ricochet, at least.
Right. That's what they thought. And I couldn't understand, you know, and the more you mull it over, the one you wonder why. Why they knew all this, why they were sitting there, why there was no one else sitting in that, standing in that particular area. I gave this talk on the 25th anniversary here to a large group in Dallas, and it was a convention to find out about more about the assassination. People came from all over the world. And the review made it to the paper, and I told them, you know, where I was standing and everything. And I said, I thought it was odd that there were so few of us over there, because Mary and I had been the only ones until right when the motor car came around and the president's car got so close, people started running in from the sides and the back. But there was no one up there at the front at that time but us. And I heard from two people that said they had been in high schools here in the city at the time, and that their buses stopped there and they were going to sing as the president went under the overpass and on out toward the trademark. And they said that policemen came up and loaded them back on the bus, and they could give me the name of their bus drivers and teachers that were with them and everything. And they actually spent the parade in a parking garage further down in town. And they couldn't understand it. She said, I've never heard anyone say that, you know, why that you were there and why no one else was. But, of course, as it turned out, it was the kill zone, and they didn't want a bunch of school children there. There was also a bunch of Catholic school children that came down, and they were made to move also. And I'm sure when that policeman that I was flirting with saw just two women there, he thought, hey, so they're not supposed to go over there. Who's going to know? And that's exactly what he said in his Warren report.
Do you recall an alternate route being published in the newspaper?
Yes, there was one published. And actually, it was a very strange route to take because there were so many places where they had to slow so much to make that double turn to get on that street. And it just was ridiculous. I can understand why later that since he had been shot, that the shooter, if he were up in the school book depository and he was supposed to pick him off, that he didn't shoot when they were coming down the street toward him before they made their turn. He had a perfect shot. He didn't have to look through trees or anything. But I feel like those shots were just to gain attention and get people looking in the wrong direction. And I think they succeeded.
Yeah, many people have made that observation, you know, including
right.
Jim Garrison and
right.
in the Oliver Stone film as well.
So I felt like Oliver made a terrific movie. It was very intense, but from everything I saw him do, he did with the utmost care and research. And I was with him in Dallas, and everything that happened in Dallas was right on the mark. And in New Orleans, the same thing. Now, I did not go with him to Washington. But I figured that if he made that much and made it so close to the truth, that why would he have changed his modus operandi when he got to Washington, D.C.? He probably did the same thing. The character played by Donald Sutherland, I think it was.
Right.
Was really a character made up of two or three persons in high office in our government, but the things they said. And I asked him, why did you combine them? You're going to be criticized for that. And he said, I know, but the movie was already so long, I had to combine the information and put it together.
Yeah, that editing sequence is one of the highlights of the film, in my opinion.
Right.
That's
I think so too.
Colonel Fletcher Prouty, and I think Gordon Novell, uh-huh. and other people that, like, as a factual bit evidence of this movie,
right.
Fletcher never did go to Washington.
Right.
But I think that Jim Garrison had gone to New York to meet with Gordon Novell mm-hmm. in a clandestine type meeting in a park and whatnot.
That's
and
right.
Fletcher had written many letters to Jim Garrison, and then when they were making the film, they were met in person and they, you know, had spoken on the phone. But, you know, it's just that it didn't really matter that much. As you say, the actual information they were talking about
is actually factual.
Artistic license on how he portrayed it, whether they
right.
were sitting on a bench or whether they actually just talked on the phone.
That's right.
Right. And the editing sequence, I think it's one of the highlights. And,
yeah, I do too.
And I usually tell people that if they ask about the film, the Oliver Stone film, I say it's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, once you watch that and you look into it, you're going to find that, yeah, there could be some things you say are not 100% true, they're just anecdotal, but when you start looking into it, it's the tip of the iceberg of the amount of real information that's there. And there's a lot that can be backed up, Ben.
Oh, I think just about all of it can be backed up. And I think it's such a crime that the Warren Commission came out with this at the behest of Lyndon Johnson to hurry up and get this all told and all out. There was no point in that except I think he was certainly, though I don't think he pulled a trigger or anything like that, being in the know makes him guilty.
Were you called before the Warren Commission?
Oh, yes. I was one of the, I was one of the few people, well, like the only one I know of, besides medical people that were interviewed at Parkland Hospital. You know, I didn't know why or to even think about it. But that's where the cameras were, was downtown where the rest of the witnesses were being interviewed. So they didn't want me around cameras at that time or someone, because they didn't want this interview to go down.
And that's,
so I was kept at Parkland, but my Warren Commission report, which I never saw until 25 years later, starts with the sentence, she was interviewed at the federal building, which is a lie.
Well, that's a great way to start, then. It makes you wonder about what's in the rest of it.
Well, the rest of it is like they took my story and tore it in little pieces and threw it up in the air, and then however it came down was the way they put it back together. But Arlen Specter, our esteemed senator from Pennsylvania, has, well, he did the same kind of number on me that he tried to do on Anita Hill. I told Oliver one time when he and I were on Oprah Winfrey's show that I said, you know, and this Anita Hill thing was on the television every day. And I said, Oliver, this man does not like people named Hill. And I said, or else people from Oklahoma, I don't know which it is. And he started laughing and he says, well, I'll have to tell Oprah that. But he was definitely a 32-year-old lawyer trying to make a big name for himself and climb quickly. And, of course, he did climb quickly.
Did you ever question whether you should be speaking out, or did you just automatically do it? Did you find...
No, I never would speak out because my children's lives were at stake, and there was a couple of attempts made on their lives also.
Oh.
So that really makes a mother hush and not say anything at all.
So were there subtle attempts, or was this directed at letting you know you had to keep quiet?
Well, some of them were pretty real, and they're all detailed in my book.
Great.
Right, the last dissenting witness.
The last dissenting witness, uh-huh. Right.
And where is that available these days?
Well, I think you can only get them from me now.
Oh, okay.
And... Well, supposedly, my publishing house burned on New Year's Eve a couple of years ago, and the books, of course, were disappeared too. But I did buy up what stock they had in another warehouse, and so I have those, and I will send them out with an autograph to people that would like to have them.
Okay, well, what we'll do on our website, we'll after the show, we'll figure out how you want to do it, if you want to give your address out, and we can post
that.
Fine. And that way people can write to you and ask just what you want for an autographed copy.
Right. I lived in the same house here in Dallas, the one I moved into, for like 37 years, and I've only moved into a secured condominium in the last two. So now I probably wouldn't be doing this talking and saying as much were I not in a secured place.
Right.
Because too many attempts were made on my life when I lived in the house. Because it was, I'm sure that some of them were real and some of them were just kooks. But either way, you can be just as dead.
So what caused you to actually decide to take part in publishing and releasing The Last Dissenting Witness? Did you feel enough time had passed?
Well, before the 25th, Jim Mars, who wrote, which I think is the definitive book on the assassination, when he wrote Crossfire, he had been trying to get me to come to one of his classes that he was teaching over here at a local college, and he had been teaching the assassination, and he had been trying to get witnesses and various people involved that were involved to come over and talk to his students. Being a teacher myself, that intrigued me, and I kept telling him that I just didn't do that. But for some reason, he kept on, and I guess this went on for 6 months. He'd call me, and I'd keep telling him, well, maybe, maybe sometime, not now. Finally, I said yes one night, and I told him to let me know where to come to, and I would be over there. Of course, I wouldn't have been there. So he said, oh, let me pick you up. So I made a mistake and let him pick me up, and sure enough, there they came. And then I felt bad, and I went on with him, and I started telling my story. He says that we would get it on tape, and we will distribute it. And that way, your story is out, and there's safety in that. Well, after 25 years, I believed that it really was maybe safe enough to say. But when Oliver Stone came to town and did the JFK film, I was so impressed by his manner of research and trying to get at the truth that I really thought he was a terrific person. And I thought, well, you know, I can do no less. There's researchers writing books and everything, but I was there. I saw this. I know what happened. So it gave me the courage to write mine.
Just to turn back to Dealey Plaza for a moment, when you actually heard the gunfire, can you describe your first impression? Did you realize right away what was happening? Did it take a moment? Did it sound like machine guns?
No. It sounded like shots. My father was a game ranger in Oklahoma, and I was his only child, so I was the boy he didn't have, and he took me with him fishing and hunting and everything, and I was very used to guns and gunshots. In fact, this policeman and I had been, we'd go shooting out in an area on the Trinity River that was much like with the overhang of rocks and banks, river banks. It was an area much like the Echo Canyon down in Dealey Plaza. And so I knew immediately that it was gunshots. I never for a moment thought it was firecrackers or all the things people said. But, so I knew it was, and everybody kept saying, but why didn't you get down? Because Mary hit the ground immediately. And she kept pulling on my slack leg saying, get down, they're shooting. And they said, well, why did you keep standing? And I said, well, because I knew I hadn't done anything. Why wouldn't anybody be shooting at me? And so I just kept standing there. And as a result, I saw things probably I shouldn't have.
How many shots do you think you heard, or was
well,
it
that's
clear
one
enough?
Of the first things they asked me when they took me into custody that day, and I kept telling them 4 to 6. He says, that isn't a number, and he got awfully angry. And I said, well, that's what I heard. I know that I heard 4 and possibly as many as 6. And he said, well, that isn't even a number. That just isn't. And he said, we're going to say three shots because three bullets is all we have right now, three casings. You know what I'm talking about. And I said, well, but I heard more than that. He said, we have three bullets, and you're going to remember that. It's all. It could be very bad for you, and things could really happen to you.
Already,
really bad will happen to you.
And that was only half an hour after the assassination?
15 minutes.
15 minutes.
Right.
And they already were giving you warnings.
Right. And you can't go and find the sniper nest in that time and count your shells and everything. You had to have known it going in. And that's when they quickly told me how many I'd heard and to stick with it.
Were your eyes on the limousine, actually, or were they on your boyfriend at the time, the shots?
Well, I was actually watching Kennedy.
Okay.
And in the line of fire, your eyes do strange things, but you can see more than just that. And I was following his head. And just as his head blew off is when I saw the flash of light from in front of us. So I've been asked, did you see the bullet? Well, I've never known anyone but Superman that could see the bullet. But at the moment that I saw it and it took it to register in my brain, his head blew off. So I know that it was a shot and that it came from the front.
Did you notice anything unusual about the car itself, about it slowing down? You had a vantage point that a lot of people watching the Zapruder film didn't get, and that there was a big sign in the way right as things started to happen.
Well, the car actually pulled over more into my lane toward my curb, and it actually, I saw the brake light. So they actually did put on the brakes, and I know it was hardly moving, if not stopped at one point.
Now, that's significant, the brake lights. The driver is supposed to know he's not supposed to be stepping on the brakes.
I mean, one of those drivers, that's what I found out later. At the time, I'd never played cops and robbers, and I didn't know all of this stuff that I found out later from people doing research on it. But, no, they should never have thrown the brakes on at any time. And I have had people send me ideas for books that they were doing that said that the man in the car seat turned around and shot Kennedy. Well, I did not see that. What I saw, I was looking from his head right straight on, and I saw a man firing from the nose. So I have no idea about what happened in the car.
Okay, if there was gunshot coming from several directions, I guess even if your eyes are taking in a lot, they can only take in so much at the same time. But you saw what you saw, and you know it was coming from the grassy knoll. And
that's right. I know it was.
And what about you? And you said your boyfriend at the time, he didn't see anything? Was he? How was he reacting to the assassination? Was he shaken up? Was he overwhelmed?
No, not really. We didn't get to talk immediately because he had been packed and was going on a hunting trip and be gone for his vacation, which is about 10 days, the minute that the parade was over. Well, they thought they'd be getting out of town very early. And, of course, this kind of stopped everything. But I didn't get to talk to him until he got back. And he told me, I said, why were you turning in such a tight turn out there that you almost ran me over? And he said, we were afraid we were going to all be hit. And said, it's a good way to look from where shots are coming from, to see what you can see if you're turning in all directions. And it's also a way to make yourself a smaller target. So he explained it that way to me, and then they couldn't believe it. But he also couldn't believe they didn't shoot the man when they were going up the street toward the depository.
So he was pretty much thinking that there was somebody other than in the book depository.
Right.
Okay. And do you know of other police officers who were on site at the time who had the same opinion?
Well, yeah, the whole motorcycle corps did.
So all of them thought so, but none of them were asked to testify for the Warren Commission, or did they give different testimony, or was it like yours?
I don't know. I didn't read their testimony, so I really can't say. I just know what I was told.
And who's to say that it was really their testimony?
Right. And if they did them like they did me, then there's no telling what they were said to have said. Because if they played so fast and loose with my testimony, in fact, Oliver Stone asked me when he let me be the secretary who takes Gene Hill's Warren Commission testimony. And he always could play on things like that in a funny way. Like he let Garrison be Earl Warren.
Yeah, but, that, great irony there.
Oh, great. I thought he was great at that. And
the other fella in the bar in the beginning there, I'm not sure if it was Perry Russo.
Right, uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, I did have one question.
All right.
If my memory is correct, you were the first person that was interviewed that, or was it you that nicknamed that little area the Grassy Knoll?
Right, uh-huh. After I had been done this way and taken in by these two men and had been threatened when I was at the courts building, they turned me loose. And you can tell how quickly, because, I mean, I'd already been in there when you can see my testimony. I mean, you can see my interview that I did that day. One of the radio stations, television stations got it. And sure enough, I had already been in that room and threatened and everything else. And I'm trying to forget what, you know, to not tell what they don't want me to tell, and yet try to tell the American people everything that I did see. It left me with in a very curious position, particularly for a country girl that had never been around anything like this.
A little wake-up call to the real world, huh?
Well, the world has never been the same since.
What happened with your friend Mary Moorman? Was she put through the same treatment?
No, because she said then, and she still says today, I still see her and still talk to her. In fact, I talked to her 2 days ago. She still says that she fell to the ground, which she did, and she was looking through her camera at the moment that the shots rang out. So she didn't see anything, just what the camera saw, and then she fell to the ground, and she's always said, I never saw anything. And she didn't.
Well, that's fair enough, and it's better that someone, if they that's their story, they stick to it, and that's what they saw.
Right.
If they didn't
I mean, what
anything,
can she say, you know?
Right.
If you'll notice in the interview we did that day, she doesn't say anything. And she stands there like she's in shock. I never saw that film again, except in the 25th anniversary. I didn't even know it existed. And then I saw it one day on TV, and I thought, my gosh, I'm talking. Mary's standing, and she's looking like she's in shock.
She probably
but
was.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things that you find out in the years since that you didn't know at first. You didn't know.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned just those little split-second gut reactions when you think something's wrong.
Right.
Like when they reached in your pocket. You
right.
wouldn't have
you
thought
know.
Anything about it, but later you thought, wait a minute, the guy didn't hesitate. He knew right away.
Well, back in 63, too, you didn't go and poke your hands in a woman's pocket.
Yeah, I bet.
Not only that, we were taught to respect government and officials. It'd be like, who are you going to call, Ghostbusters? Because, you know, you just kind of thought the policeman's word was law and that they were on the right side. And we turned out that everything was going to heck that day and there were no right answers. And there were no right people. And it all swung over in just an instant.
Do you recall when you actually put the film in your pocket?
I was putting them in after each shot she took. I'd pull them out of the camera because it was Polaroid. And at that time, you had to coat them with a fixative for them to work. And so I would coat the, so that we could keep on shooting pictures, I grabbed a picture and coat it with a fixative and stick it in my pocket. We weren't even looking at what we were getting. We were just trying to keep shooting.
Do you know how many pictures there were that they took?
I think there were about six or eight. I'm not real sure, even today.
So you don't know how many of them you've seen since, by comparison? You said some of them you've seen in these recent years.
Well, one famous Mormon photo.
Just
that one, right?
Right, uh-huh.
Yeah.
But one of the pictures that we took right at the beginning I remember when we got that back, they came and picked them all up. But, you know, they had them, and they didn't give them back. And they went to, you know, Mary kept fighting for the pictures, and finally got them back later. And I saw this one that we had taken right at the first where Mary's rather short, and it's an incline right there, a little hill. And she was aiming up to take a picture of her boyfriend, who was the very first motorcycle. He was on point, they call it. And she took that picture as he came around the corner then. And we got, in that very instant, with the motorcade right there, we, right there by the school book depository, we got the picture of the sixth floor. And when it came back to us, the background had been destroyed. Now, what better way for the government to say, look, Oswald did it, and here he is, because it would have been him in the window, because we had a picture at that very moment. But no, they destroyed the background before they gave it back to us, because I don't think he was there shooting.
How do you mean destroyed the background?
I just mean it wasn't there anymore.
So the picture came back completely changed.
Mutilated, uh-huh. Yeah, that had been, I don't know what they do to it, but the background had been mutilated.
Wow.
So that right there, I thought, was one of the best ways to say, hey, look here. Here's this man, and that's who we're telling you did it. And yet, they didn't give her that picture back. Not complete, anyway. So, they weren't too interested in using and in claiming Oswald. Well, they were very interested, but they knew that one, he wasn't going to be there, so.
Right, so any evidence that didn't support their theory, they made sure
they
never...
made sure it was God. And I think, really, they didn't dream that there would be somebody stupid enough to go and talk like I was. So, they did everything they could to discredit me from then on. I know that he said that to me, and he said he could make me look as crazy as Oswald's mother, Marguerite. And he said, and everybody knows how crazy she is.
But, and he told you that personally?
Yes, he surely did. And
when was that?
That was when he interviewed me for the Warren Report. Oh, and what I started to tell you a while ago, and I got off on something else.
Mm-hmm.
When we did this scene, and I was with Oliver, and I was supposed to be the court reporter, taking the testimony, Gene Hill's testimony. He said, Gene, you better figure out how to do some court reporting and how you do that. And I said, why? And he said, well, aren't you going to, he said, I'm going to let you play that part, and you better, you know, at least learn enough to where you look authentic doing it. I said, but Oliver, there wasn't a court reporter at my hearing. There was only a lady with a steno pad taking shorthand, and she had to leave the room every time that our inspector wanted her to. So I said, she wasn't in there for half of my supposed testimony.
So does that mean that half your testimony actually didn't end up on the record anywhere? You were just speaking...
That's right. I was just, it was sort of a fuss between me and our inspector.
So let me get this straight then. She was asked to leave. You guys were going off the record at various points?
Oh, yeah.
And this happened more than once?
Oh, yeah. Several times. I was out there quite a long time.
Oh, okay. So, forgive me for not knowing exact facts, so just let's run this again. You were testifying to Warren,
to Arlen Specter.
Right, Arlen Specter, for the Warren Commission.
Right.
And what time period was this over, like an hour or 2 hours, a whole afternoon?
Probably, I think I was probably there for almost 2 hours.
And at several times he broke to go off the record and then wanted to chastise you or bully you?
Right, oh yes. And he knew that I was a divorcee, just a brand new divorcee, and he knew I just chain smoked, and he wouldn't let me have cigarettes or anything. I mean, he was just more or less trying to torture me, you know, because back then you could smoke just about anywhere you wanted to. And he wouldn't let me have a cigarette. He wouldn't let me do anything. He wouldn't let me have coffee. He just made me sit there and listen to his blathering. So he was really trying to do a work with my head.
Did you recognize that at the time, or were you just so
I was
nervous?
So frustrated. My daughter says, I heard her tell someone at one time not too long ago. She said, I could not believe my mother. She said, he had her so completely shaken that she was just beside herself when she got home. She was.
How old was your daughter at the time?
She was in the, she was about 12. And I was taking her to a, I was taking her to a school-sponsored opera that day when Oswald shot, when Ruby shot Oswald. And I was walking toward the TV to turn it off. We didn't have remote control then. And I was telling her, we're going to be late, and I started screaming, come quick, come quick. Here's the man I saw down on the knoll that day. He's the one that was running. And, of course, she can remember all this, too. She can. She knows all this happened.
Yeah, well, days like that, memories linger right on. You know exactly what you do, and you remember
right.
What you were wearing, and the shock of it freezes that memory.
It really does.
And, of course, you being firsthand there, right there in Texas, right there being a witness, and then getting a glimpse of Ruby, recognizing him. The only other thing, I guess, it would be great if you had recognized at all someone behind the fence there. People have mentioned they thought he was in a police uniform, the gunman. I'm speaking about, do you have any recollection or just the flash?
I'm sorry?
I'm just saying you wouldn't recognize anyone else from the Knoll area, would you?
Probably not.
Yeah, it just
probably was. Not. In fact, this will maybe won't be even of interest to you, but maybe some of your viewers, listeners, or whatever would know the name of Billy Saul Estes.
Oh, right, yeah.
He was the money man for LBJ.
Yeah.
And I know him very well. And I don't know what I'm going to tell you about him. I have these lapses now, so I'll remember in a minute like I did that while ago.
Oh, that's fine. I think,
Oh, by the way, I do know Madeline Brown real well, and I knew her son that was just her son by LBJ.
Right.
And he was just as big and ugly as LBJ. He looked a lot like him. And so that, you know, it was no doubt to me that that child was her, you know, was LBJ's son. And, of course, she was left with the farms and ranches and stuff here in Texas that came from him. And he told her, I think it was the day before, that the Kennedys would never bother him again, that he would see to it.
That's LBJ's son.
No, that's LBJ was telling Madeline Brown.
Oh,
I
okay.
Believe.
Telling Madeline Brown, his mistress.
Yeah.
I see.
That the Kennedys wouldn't be bothering him anymore.
And that's what she told you firsthand.
Oh, yes. Definitely.
Yeah, because I've heard that before. The
she told me firsthand. In fact, I even take her to the hospital now and everything. She has cancer. And I was with her when her son died. So I've, you know, been around and heard her story and talked to her about it. And actually tried to trip her up on things. But I do believe it.
Yeah, I believe that she had mentioned that around Christmas time was the first time she got to meet LBJ after November 22nd.
Yeah.
And she had brought up the subject that, you know, a lot of people in Texas are wondering, Lyndon, you know, did you have a hand in this? And he made the comment to her that it was, big oil money and the Pentagon, and she should never bring
right,
that up
but
again.
This statement that he made to her was made shortly, a day or two before.
Right,
then.
Beforehand.
Huh?
Yeah, like you say, beforehand. So
yeah,
that means
beforehand.
He would have had to be somewhat inside the loop.
Prior knowledge.
Yeah.
And I knew the policeman that was riding on the motorcycle policeman that was riding protection on his car, and he said that LBJ got down in the seat, dived down just seconds before the shots rang out.
His feeling was before?
Yes.
Meaning he knew of the place.
Meaning that he dodged, and why would he have dodged if he didn't have prior knowledge?
Well, that's interesting. I never heard that before.
No, I haven't. Now, the only thing that Fletcher has brought up, his position, and it's just a bit of insight. The first question that Lyndon Johnson asked J. Edgar Hoover, was that, were they shooting at me, too?
Right.
And thinking it from that angle, you would guess that maybe Lyndon didn't exactly know how many shots or where, but if he ducked down ahead of time, that would give you the indication he knew what was going
on. Well, I think, too, that realizing that Connelly was hit.
Yeah.
And everything, thought maybe the plan had gone awry.
Or maybe wondering if they were all expendable at that point, perhaps.
Yeah, that would have been an interesting situation if they were both killed. But then they would never explain that on a lone nut. You know?
Right, they couldn't have. And that magic bullet.
Yeah. Well, you know, there must be, I think, I've never bothered to count up 100 items, but you surely could make 100 items. Any one of them would break the whole thing to any reasonable person. And when you look at that bullet, Commission Exhibit 399, you say there's no way that this did anything but got shot into a bucket of water.
Right.
And then the rifle, well, the scope wasn't even aligned. Even to shoot it, they have to align it. And then, like you say, the parade route, and then the destruction of evidence, and then the disinformation of people such as yourself, and other people who witnessed Jack Ruby that day in getting out of a pickup truck, or at least being in a pickup truck and somebody in the back getting out, and other people. The list goes on and on to the tune of 100 items.
Oh yeah, it could be your millennium list.
Yeah.
Of the 100 things about the assassination that were really not true.
Or
that really happened that they didn't say.
Burning the autopsy notes.
Mm-hmm.
You know who does that? And like, unless they were threatened, just like yourself. And
right. Even, cleaning the suit.
Yeah. Washing the car. Yeah. Cleaning the suit and washing the car right away.
Right.
I mean, it's kind of awkward that we chuckle about it or something, but it's almost unreal. It's almost unreal for a reasonable person to look into this. And when you hear on CNN, I mean, the latest garbage I hear is that the Martin Luther King trial, the FBI looked into it again and found nothing wrong. You know, James Earl Wade was the only...
You know, a lot of people came to my house that they were working on that. And from the stories they told, it sounds like the FBI did another cover-up on James Earl Ray. That's when they were working to get him a new trial and everything.
Yeah.
So, it just goes on.
Yeah, and I think that the more naive you are about political things, the more shocked you are, because if you get a little more worldly, you kind of shrug your shoulders and say that kind of thing goes on. But when you don't have a clue about it, and like you say, a person such as yourself, from the Midwest, when you're there, you're kind of taught instinctively to respect the police, to respect Secret Service or FBI, and there's no way in the back of your mind you're thinking that they'd be part of the cover-up.
Right.
You'd be the first thing from your thought, except for the little, like you said in an anecdotal way, just little something didn't seem right. How did the guy know to go for my pocket?
Right.
How did they have that vantage point just minutes after the assassination?
There are too many things.
Right, that, like you say, at the time, you didn't think about, it was just a big blur of things, but when you start analyzing every little frame, every little second of that time, you say, wait a minute, that guy was running in the opposite direction of where we thought shots were coming from, and someone had to be watching me. And
well, I know that this friend of mine, Bob Bruno, that told you about me.
Oh, right, yeah.
He came down here, and I took him. In fact, Madeline Brown went with us, and I took he and his daughter to the house where Oswald lived, the rooming house, and then to a place where he had lived with Marina, and on to Ruby's apartment in the Texas Theater, and showed him the route and everything. And, you know, to just an observer, it's impossible to do what they said he did, to leave the scene.
Yeah.
And walk and do all these things. There was one thing that has really never come out that, I guess it must have, but you don't hear much about it. But the guys, I was the only unmarried woman in this bunch of people with the policemen. And my boyfriend was a married policeman. But it was said around my kitchen table because it was the good place to meet, you know. That was a very safe house for everybody. And it was mentioned that at least they thought that Tippett took Oswald away from the scene of the crime, which would have been a perfect way to have gotten him away because they could hardly crawl through there in a cab or a bus, but a police car could go right through everything and could have gotten him where they wanted him to be. And, of course, Tippett was killed because of it. So,
you know, I hadn't heard that before.
Right. Hardly anyone has. But
well, that's an interesting point because, I mean, the Secret Service descended on you so quickly, yet Oswald was supposed to come down from the sixth floor of the building and actually leave a nearby building without anybody stopping him and then, you know, get home.
Get on a bus.
Right.
But they weren't. The crowds were so that you couldn't even move down there.
Well, not only that, if I recall correctly, Oswald was going to get in a cab.
Right.
And there was a woman beside him, and when they opened the door, he said, okay, ma'am, well, you go ahead of me then.
Right.
So, like, I just shot the president, but I can wait for the bus, no
right.
problem.
Sure.
And I think somebody had said the first getaway by public transport.
Well, but it really wasn't so, because I really think Officer Tippett, he was out of his zone. He did not make radio contact. They couldn't find him. And the reason they couldn't is because he was where he shouldn't be, picking up Oswald. Because they proved that he definitely knew Oswald. Because he was one of those guys that used to hang around Jack Ruby's place all the time. Officer Tippett was. In fact, he was dating a girl down there.
And so what was the feeling a week or two afterwards that somehow Tippett had stumbled into something or that he was maybe set up and marked, a marked man from the word go?
Well, I don't think people knew what to think. I really don't. Of course, I can't really have an objective view because I kind of knew the inside story too well. And I was hearing a different story from the policeman than anybody else was getting in the newspaper. So
but that's interesting that the policemen were actually quite vocal talking amongst themselves about it.
Oh, yeah.
Yet years later, I mean, granted, I'm not as much of an assassination expert in the JFK realm as a lot of people, but I didn't realize that they'd even said anything, any of them. It seems like a big hush to me, so.
Well, because they were told. I mean, we knew there was no one at my house listening to anything we said, hopefully. But they were told they'd lose their pensions, they'd be fired, that they would lose their pensions and everything if anybody said a word. And they were called in to detail on it. Their meeting, they were called in and called in and called in and threatened and threatened. Their lockers were gone through and everything. And they knew something was wild going afoot, and they did not want to be caught in this. And everybody hushed.
Yeah, did you know Roger Craig at all?
And just barely.
Yeah. And he was one of the only persons, I think, that spoke up about it, and he
Well, he soon didn't stay awake very long.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
I mean, they took care of him.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's really everybody that's been involved just about. I was wondering one time, and I said, I can't understand why and how I was able to live through this when so many people have been killed. And my mother replied, well, I guess because I stayed on my knees all the time. And she said, I think the prayers, you know, protected you. I don't know.
Well, now
it protected me.
Now it's many years later, and you're speaking out to some degree. How often do people actually ask you, like we've asked you, to come forward and tell your story? Are you doing a fair bit of that now, or is it just
an
occasional?
Well, it kind of goes in cycles. This year has been a very busy year. I went to Tennessee and spoke to a district conference of Rotarians. I was a parade marshal in Chicago, and this Memorial Day. I speak to a group of advertising executives in Fort Worth next week, next Thursday, and it kind of goes like that, and then you all tonight. You just don't know. Of course, it's gotten slower and everything with the years, but I always try to go to any school meeting and talk to any school children, high school or college, that I can, and I made it a point in the beginning to never take money for what I said, because if you do, then people can say, like they do about Marina, well, somebody must have offered her quite a bit of money this time, because now she's saying this, or now she's saying that. And I wanted no one to ever be able to say that she takes money and then tells it the way they want her to.
Well, I doubt that they'll do that then. It's very commendable that you do talk to schools, because these are the people that at some point are going to make decisions. And even if one thing doesn't really get changed in a big way, general attitudes and awareness changes, and people aren't going to be so easily duped the next time. Now with the Internet, if what had happened back then had happened now, you know, the information would have fired around so quickly, they wouldn't have been able to put a lid on all the witnesses.
No, nor, and there would have been camcorders down there. Just, you know, there would have been, everybody would have had a tape of it.
Yeah, and it would have worked to your advantage, because the scare tactics that the police and
well, but the
people
fact
in authority...
Now, you can't use those scare tactics on most people.
Yeah, or people are almost indignant.
Right. And plus, we're very much more wary of the powers that be. We're not so trusting.
Yeah, well, enough demonstrators have been pepper sprayed up here in Canada that definitely people don't sit down and take it anymore.
Yeah, and in Seattle and in Washington.
Yeah, Seattle and Washington, they've had their share of that too.
Well, I think I told you that I came to Abbotsford and spoke at college there. And in Vancouver, Abbotsford.
Yeah, that's just outside of Vancouver, yeah.
Yeah. And I've gone to, you know, all these kinds of places, a lot of different places. And everywhere I go, I kind of marvel in a way of the interest, but of the fact that people that thought they were studying it really did not know a lot of the things. So I kind of felt like I had a mission to get the truth out.
So you've all often seen people surprised by, you know, they didn't actually expect to hear you say what you were saying then.
Right.
I do have a question that was emailed into us. The question was, do you feel that you were on the grass at the time of the shot, like on the curb, or actually walking out onto the street?
I was right at the curb. I had been in the street, but back on the curb at the time of the shot.
And being six shots, the first shots must have been, I guess, just when the car was right up beside you or right before you.
Just before me, but the headshot was right in line with me.
Yeah, so, I mean, you could study the Zapruder film, I guess, to see exactly...
Right, yes, you can.
Because as you say, if the first shot was, as they call it, a diversionary shot, people would turn around and look up. In fact, myself, I think maybe other shots had come from a second floor of the Daltex building and...
Right.
And maybe the fifth floor, right at the very front of the... of the Texas School Book Depository, where the that little cypress nest, it would have taken too long to put it all together like that.
It surely would.
For them to be out of there. And I think there's a photo within 3.5 seconds afterward that shows the window empty.
Right.
And
I don't see how they can put that all together like that, you know, and come up with the conclusions that they've come up with.
No, it's actually a complete fraud, but you know, in a court of public opinion, you can say that it's not been proven in court just because they own the court system. But
you know, back in '63, we weren't questioning the government.
No,
everything is questioned now.
Yeah.
From Waco up and down.
Yeah, I think the last thing about Waco I heard is they lost the front door.
Right.
So, you know, that kind of goes to prove on who was shooting first. If there was, you know, 100 rounds right through the front door on the way in and maybe two or three going on the way out, it was like...
Yeah.
But, well, I don't have to get into that. That's a whole other show.
That's another show.
Yeah. But now, since people have really studied the Zapruder film to see exactly where people were and where you were with regards to your memory...
Right.
Do you feel that there has been any, in your mind, tampering with that film from what you recall being there and then seeing the film later and thinking, well, wait a minute. I mean, some people have actually claimed they think the car came to a stop.
And I know. Well, as I said, you know, I saw the brake lights and everything.
Right.
So I know it probably, you know, really was stopped. But I noticed when I watched the Zapruder film, and I have seen it I don't know how many times.
Yeah.
But you know how, we didn't get to see that film until many, many years later, if you remember.
Well, it would have to be after, I think, 1975?
After Jim Garrison pulled it forward?
Well, that and when they called the House Select Committee.
Oh, okay, right in 78.
Right, on assassinations. But in the Zapruder film, I watch, and my head turns with him. You know, I mean, I'm standing there, but my head is turning with Kennedy. You know, it's following. So I think that kind of goes along with what I said, you know, that my sight was on him, and that's how come I saw the shot from the nose.
Oh, fair enough. If you, you know, didn't get to see the film till, what was it, you know, 13 or 15 years later,
right.
You're just as curious actually what happened as compared to your memory as anyone else. I think that we're quite curious that there are missing frames in it, and some there appears to be a jump in it, and we wish that sign wasn't there. We could see a lot more.
Right.
I think other people even thought that a bullet went through the sign, the reason it was taken down the next day, the freeway sign.
Right.
And there's another point I wanted to ask you. After, right after you were approached by the FBI man, and then you ran up the hill, when you came back down, there were still people milling around searching for anything, and I think a bullet was found by Buddy Walters.
Right.
Do you recall any of the aftermath?
No, because, I was in custody.
So they took you right away to that other building.
Yeah.
So there was no lingering at all. It was right away you were, that would have to be within a minute or two?
Yeah, that just took me immediately. I mean, the time it took for me to run across the street, they had me sacked up and marched over to the...
So did you recall anything else in the back of your mind while you were on your way over there that...
No, sir, I was just fighting with those men.
Right, right, and as in the Oliver Stone movie, they were being rather rough with you.
They really were. It was the most painful hold I've ever had put on me.
Right.
I asked my boyfriend about it later, about what was so horribly painful about it. And he said that's a hold that we're taught to put on a felon that's an unruly felon. So I can certainly see how it would stop somebody, because there's a nerve evidently in your neck that they know what to push on to render you, you know, just almost, I can't even think about it without feeling it.
Did you see other witnesses being rounded up as you were?
No.
So,
as I said, I was too involved in what was happening to me.
Right.
To even look around. I did see witnesses once we, you know, after I got out of the room at the courthouse.